Pakistan declares a state of emergency as more than 30 million people are affected by devastating flooding across much of the country. Russia accuses Ukraine of shelling the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. Moscow and Kiev have been trading blame for shelling near the plant since its capture by Russia. Plus, a strike by Scottish refuse workers over pay is spreading to more cities as the cost of living crisis triggers a wave of industrial action across the UK. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Pakistan has been grappling with monsoon flooding that has swept much of the country. Officials say the death toll has almost reached the 1,000 mark since mid-June. The government has declared an emergency and has mobilized the military. Thousands of residents in critical areas have been ordered to evacuate their homes. Pakistan has called for international assistance to cope with the aftermath of the natural disaster. Authorities say this year's monsoon flooding has affected over 33 million people and nearly 1 million homes have been destroyed or badly damaged. This year's floods are comparable to those of 2010, the worst on record. That year, over 2,000 people died and nearly a fifth of the country was underwater. Nasser Kazmi joined us a short while ago from the flood-hit city of Nowshera with the latest updates.
The water level is coming up as the time is passing. More rain is expecting in the next 24 hours. So Pakistanis are in real trouble at the moment, especially people living in Balochistan province, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, and the Sindh province. There are a lot of people who are still stranded in the flood's water. And the concern is that how long this rain will continue in the country. Rescue operations are taking place, but still a lot of things have to be done in this regard. The government is trying very hard to cope with the situation. The parliamentarians have announced that they will donate their 1 month's salary for the flood donation. Same time, the government has announced a huge amount for the flood relief activities, but international aid is very necessary for the people who are in trouble at the moment.
Kiev and Moscow have once again accused each other of shelling Europe's largest nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine. The Ukraine state nuclear company warned of a risk of radioactive leak at the Zaporizhzhia facility. The company said Russia has repeatedly attacked its infrastructure over the past 24 hours. Moscow authorities said Ukrainian forces have attacked the complex three times in the same period. On Thursday, the plant was disconnected from the Ukrainian grid for the first time in its history, but the connection was later restored. Disconnecting from the grid may lead to a catastrophic failure of the cooling systems at the site. Russia captured Zaporizhzhia in March, but the facility is run by Ukrainian technicians. Protesters have gathered outside the office of the British energy regulator Ofgem in London. That came after Ofgem confirmed the cost of electricity and gas will rise by 80% as of October the 1st.
Energy price cap rise, which has risen to over £3,500, is intolerable for working people, for people in poverty, for people out of work in Britain right now. I'm here because our parliamentary political parties have failed us, continue to fail us. Whether Labour or Conservative, they offer no solution to the people already in poverty and in worse situations, and to the people who will be put into poverty come October when this price cap rise comes into effect.
The protest was organized by Don't Pay UK. That is a campaign calling on people to stop paying their bills at the renewed prices. Ofgem has partly blamed the increase on the Russia-Ukraine war that has led to a curb in Russian energy supplies to Europe. Leaders of parliaments in Wales and in Scotland, as well as British opposition parties, have called for an immediate freeze on the price increase. Britons are also grappling with soaring food prices. That, coupled with the rising energy prices, sent inflation to above 10% in July, a rate unseen in over 40 years. Scotland is hit by industrial action. Refuse workers have been on a strike for 9 days now or a pay dispute with local authorities. The strike began in the capital, Edinburgh, now spreading to more than a dozen cities. The action is set to continue until Tuesday, despite talks ongoing between authorities and union leaders. The workers want higher salaries in line with the rising inflation. The action has already left this impact, with garbage from unattended bins overflowing to the streets. It has caused criticism against the government as well. Opposition politicians are accusing it of apathy in the dispute and shifting blame onto local city councils. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman has warned Americans of painful action as the country struggles to curb soaring inflation.
Reducing inflation is likely to require a sustained period of below-trend growth. Moreover, there will very likely be some softening of labor market conditions. While higher interest rates, slower growth, and softer labor market conditions will bring down inflation, they will also bring some pain to households and businesses.
As Powell outlined the government's plans to tame inflation, he noted that it would take some time to restore price stability. But he stressed that the current economic situation in the U.S. requires using the, quote, tools forcefully. Powell also warned of far greater pain if outlined measures are not adopted. Inflation has hit a four-decade high in the U.S. as prices for gas, food, and rent continue to climb at the fastest pace. Mike Harris, finance editor at Veterans Today, joins us from Phoenix. We also have Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist, joining us from Toronto. Welcome to you both. Mike Harris, let's see how bad the situation really is in the States and whether what Powell is subscribing to, which is obviously taming inflation through the interest rates, is that actually going to work?
Well, I don't know. What they've done is they've printed and created so much money, and Biden administration has been physical, so irresponsible with these new programs that they've been passing. I really don't see a way out of this. We had a news article this week that came out that said 20 million American households are behind on their electrical bills, can't afford power. How is this going to impact the population? And so these things, they really made a mess out of this, all in all. They've just been printing way too much money. The government's been spending way too much money. We're really in a bind here, and I don't see any easy way out of it. And I don't know that if raising the interest rates is going to help, because by raising the interest rates, you're going to have marginal businesses, which are barely servicing their debt now, are not going to be able to service the debt. The cost of federal borrowing is going to go up. And so you're going to have more of the federal budget is going to be going to interest payments versus doing anything productive for the people. They've really got themselves into the death part of the downward spiral here. They're really stuck, and they don't have very many good choices, if any good choices, ahead of them.
Well, Eric Wahlberg, while we're seeing the squeeze on Americans through a variety of things that are happening in that country, like inflation, for example, or high energy prices, I'm wondering how Americans feel when they hear almost on a weekly basis, if not maybe just a few days apart, at some points, that Ukraine is getting billions and billions of dollars from the U.S. I think the latest at this point was $3 billion, putting it at over $10 billion.
It's terrible, and Americans are turning against this. The positive opinion for pursuing this war against Russia are steadily decreasing. It's now less than half of Americans actually approve of this war. I believe it was slightly over 50. I think it's just under now and continuing to fall. So that, and Mike is right, just putting the jacking up interest rate, that's just going to create, its main effect will be to create recession and also to put unemployment increase so that you have wages to try and control wages. But you see, this militancy in the U.S. Since COVID and even this Floyd, there's just a lot of unrest in the U.S. And it's on a mass level. So the It's going to really backfire to just rely. It's a cowardly way of trying to fight inflation, jacking up interest rates. You don't. You just sign something, and then you sit back and you wait for the mess. But there is a perfect. Mike says he has no idea how to deal with this. Well, I certainly do, and I think most people in the world realize that the way to deal with this is to jack up not interest rates, but taxes on the rich. That's how you deal with inflation. But that takes guts. And show me an American government or Canadian or any Western government now with any guts, and I will shake your hand.
One of the focuses of what is happening in the States, or one of the reasons, Mike Harris, if you agree, is the rising energy prices that has led to a variety of consequences such as inflation. But it's not just about the energy price being what it is, but and the U.S. economy to be in a state because of the Ukraine conflict. But rather, before the Ukraine conflict started, do you agree that the state of the U.S. economy was not exactly in tip-top shape? And that doesn't just get is applicable to the U.S. Many countries actually around the world were not doing that well economically speaking, even not during COVID, even before COVID happened.
Well, I agree. This has been a long, lingering problem. The U.S. Voluntarily gutted their manufacturing base and gutted their economy by passing NAFTA, GATT, and letting China into the WTO when they exported over 35, 40 million jobs into China. So even if the Fed would stimulate the economy through low interest rate, it does no good to the U.S. manufacturing base and the U.S. working class, because those jobs no longer reside in the United States. They're resident in China. It'll pump up the Chinese economy, but it doesn't help the U.S. economy. So the Fed has really sort of hogtied themselves, along with fiscal policy has embraced. And these are all feckless policies that have been going back to Ronald Reagan. He's the one who first started deficit spending. And that was supposed to be temporary to jumpstart the economy. It worked good for a while, but they never went back to a balanced budget. We have fiat currency that has no intrinsic value. And right now, the global economy, or the global countries, transaction, commerce, business, are really second guessing if the dollar is really the right place to put their investment. And the dollar seems to be doing better than other currencies now, but it is merely the cleanest shirt and the dirty hamper. So it looks better than other economies, but not much. So they've got some problems, and they really have to start looking at things like broad-scale debt forgiveness, perhaps, against working class to benefit working class people. But how do you do that and not injure the inventive class? So they've really got a sticky wicket here. There is no easy solution like just raising taxes on the rich. I mean, you could raise taxes on everybody who makes more than $500,000 a year and still not put a dent in the deficit spending that this government has. It takes a multi-pronged approach of reducing government spending, stopping this stupid spending they've been doing on these idiotic wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, now in Ukraine, stop all this nonsense, trim back the social spending in the U.S. as far as your welfare and other things, and try to put this country back to work, get us on an ability to restore our manufacturing base here and bring jobs back to the U.S. We don't need the illegal aliens that are coming in the country, undermining the wages of the working class people, is damaging entry-level jobs the most, the hardest. So our least capable, most vulnerable people are paying the hardest price for this. So the U.S. really is in a bind, and I look for some real, real pain as the Federal Reserve tries to tinker their way out of this. I think it's time to do away with the Federal Reserve and restore these functions back to the U.S. Treasury.
Thank you, Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist. Mike Harris, thank you. Finance editor at Veterans Today from Phoenix. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. Gunfire and explosions have rocked the Libyan capital, Tripoli, as clashes erupt between rival armed groups, raising fears of an all-out conflict in a country grappling with a political crisis. The violence has left at least one person dead. Health officials say an unknown number of civilians have also been wounded. there are reports of indiscriminate shelling in civilian populated neighborhoods. A mosque and a health clinic were reportedly set on fire. The UN's Libya mission has called for an immediate cessation of hostilities. The two rival administrations based in Tripoli and Tobruk are exchanging blame for the violence. The government of national unity, led by Abdelhamid Dibaba, says that the fighting broke out after negotiations to avoid bloodshed and the city collapsed. Beba's government was installed in Tripoli last year as part of a UN-led peace process to lead a transition to elections. His administration is challenged by the Tobruk-based administration of former interior minister Fathi Bashagha. Bashagha is backed by Libya's parliament and eastern-based military strongman Khalifa Haftar. Tunisia says that it will recall its ambassador to Rabat for consultations following a similar move by Morocco. Relations between the North African neighbors have soured in recent days. That after the Tunisian president hosted the head of the Polisario Front, Brahim Ghali, who arrived in Tunis on Friday to attend a high-profile conference. The move angered Morocco, since the movement seeks independence in the Western Sahara, which Morocco sees as a sovereign part of its own territory. Rabat called the move, quote, hostile and unnecessarily provocative. It also withdrew its Tunis ambassador for consultations and canceled its participation in the Japanese-African Investment Conference. The Tunisian Foreign Ministry has expressed surprise at Morocco's reaction. It says that Tunis has maintained total neutrality on the Western Sahara issue with respect to international law. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov recently visited Africa and said Moscow is currently developing a new foreign policy to counter fresh Western sanctions. Speaking in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, on the last leg of his landmark visit to Africa last July, Lavrov noted that many countries are ending reliance on the United States dollar.
The reliance on dollar as the instrument supporting the world economy is not very promising, frankly speaking. And it is not by incident that more and more countries are shifting to using alternative currencies, shifting to use national currencies more and more, this process will be gaining momentum.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today's edition is focusing on the recent visit to Africa by Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in what was seen as a diplomatic charm offensive amid tensions with Western countries over Moscow's military operations in Ukraine. The second part of our show will be on a report of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, which urged African countries to rethink export diversification. So stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Russia counters West in Africa. Late July, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited four African countries in a bid to strengthen ties with the continent amid a six-month-old conflict in Ukraine. Lavrov visited Egypt, the Republic of the Congo, Uganda, and Ethiopia, where he met with high-level officials and held discussions on bilateral, regional, and international relations. Speaking to Sputnik News, Lavrov described African countries as trying to define their own futures and solve their own problems as part of a trend towards a multipolar world. He accused the West of opposing such multipolar world in its pursuit of U.S. hegemony.
Africa's ties with Russia are based on Russia's historical support for the anti-colonial movement in Africa. Speaking during the 2019 Russia-Africa summit in Sochi, Russian President Vladimir Putin elaborated on the historical ties between the two sides.
Gathered here today are representatives of all 54 African countries and leading regional organizations. Dear friends, Russia and Africa are tied with traditionally friendly relationship. Our country has been consistently supporting the national liberation movement of the peoples of Africa. It has contributed significantly into the emerging of young states, developing their economy, establishing combat-capable armed forces. Our cooperation, which goes back to the period of joint fight against colonialism, is of strategic and long-term nature.
Now, to discuss the recent visit to Africa by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, we contacted Greg Simons, author and researcher, and would like to thank him for accepting our invitation today. Now, our first question, Africa and Russia enjoyed very cordial ties, especially during the Soviet Union, but these relations waned after the collapse of the Union. Now, what is the motivation behind Russia's renewed strategic interest in Africa?
Well, I mean, if you look at what Russia has been saying and doing in terms of its foreign policy priorities over the last at least 10, 15 years, it's been reorienting itself away from this Western-centric world towards a non-Western-centric world. And Africa has been part of that. And, I mean, in terms of relationships, certainly. I mean, if we look at the Soviet Union and its support for the independence movements and, in some cases, some of the reconstruction aid which was given during the formative years of African countries' independence, it's got a good basis for coming back.
During his visit to Uganda, Sergei Lavrov got a warm reception from President Yoweri Museveni, who had been a key ally of the West for decades. During the meeting with Lavrov, Museveni defended his country's relationship with Russia. The Ugandan president was emphatic that his country cannot be against Russia. Let's take a listen.
And that is our relationship with Russia. Russia, so the Soviet Union, supporting the anti-colonial movement in Africa. We say, but you people, these people have been with us for the last 100 years. How can we be automatically against them? We have even forgiven our former enemies, the colonialists, the ones who had colonized us, the ones who had actually taken slaves from here and did bad things. We have forgiven them, and we are working with them. How can we be against somebody who has never harmed us and who instead helped us?
Now, I would like to ask Mr. Simon his opinion about this statement by President Museveni.
Well, of course, I mean, he's saying it rather, well, directly, that the West has never really been there to help Uganda. I mean, they talk about these things, but, of course, the British colonised it, and Americans have been exploiting not only Uganda but the African continent, depending on where resources are most abundant. So what he's saying is that there is a basis of a symmetrical and a reciprocal relationship between Russia and African countries, which has not been poisoned, if we want to call it that, by historical experience of colonization by other European powers.
Trade between African countries and Russia has seen considerable progress. Speaking during the Russia-Africa summit in 2019, President Putin said Russian companies have been working in Africa for a long time now.
We see diversification of Russian export. Its structure is changing towards non-commodities. Russian companies have been quite successfully working in the region for a long time, mostly dealing with geological service and mineral resources extraction in energy, oil, and gas sectors. At the same time, steps are being made to establish cooperation in high tech.
Currently, Russian exports to Africa are worth $14 billion a year, and imports of African products stand at about $5 billion. This represents a doubling in Russian-African trade since 2015, or an average annual growth rate of 15%. African countries stand to gain, especially economically and politically, from improved ties with Russia.
That Russia is open to different forms of ties with Africa. I mean, they already have what they would term as humanitarian ties in terms of these research and education programs which African students attend. But I mean, this would be going more into business and the area of forming some kind of financial relationship, which is mutually beneficial.
The United States is in the process of passing a law titled Countering Malign Russian Activities in Africa Act. This law, already passed by the House of Representatives, seeks to punish African states that back certain Russian actions and could have major implications for African countries. This legislation has attracted sharp criticism in Africa.
South African Minister of International Relations Naledi Pandor slammed the legislation as she hosted U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken during his recent visit to the country. Let's take a listen.
But in terms of our interaction with some of our partners in Europe and elsewhere, there has been a sense of a patronizing bullying toward you choose this or else. And the recent legislation passed in the United States of America by the House of Representatives, we found a most unfortunate bill that we'd hoped the media would say more about, because when we believe in freedom, as I'm saying, it's freedom for everybody. You can't say because Africa is doing this, you will then be punished by the United States. So that's been a disappointing passage of legislation by one house, and we hope the other house will not agree to such offensive legislation.
Now, do you think other African countries will also resist this law, which seeks to undermine the independence and sovereignty of countries across the continent?
Well, I think this is an act of desperation from the US. I mean, they've been the bully on the block, uncontested, for at least since the collapse of the Cold War and the Soviet Union. And so they've been able to do what they want, when they want, and there's been no consequences. But if we look at the reaction, for example, of the South African foreign minister, who was beside Blinken at the time, she said, "We don't take orders from you. We act in our own interests." So if anything, and this would be in keeping with other poorly considered coercive US foreign policy lately, that it is more likely to actually accelerate the isolation of the US in the world, because they see it for what it is, a bully that exploits.
Immediately after the Russian foreign minister concluded his African visit, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited three African countries, including South Africa, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Rwanda. U.S. Ambassador to the UN Thomas Greenfield also visited Ghana, Cape Verde, and Uganda after Lavrov's trip to the East African country.
And my last question now, can Washington undo the gains made by Russia in the continent over the recent past?
Well, I mean, we've seen what they've been... Africa, like other non-Western countries, is watching what the United States is doing in Europe and in Asia, and they see nothing of benefit for them. In fact, they see risks and threats for them. They might tour, they might get a somewhat cordial welcome, but you can see the difference between how on the African continent Putin and Lavrov were welcomed as opposed to these other ones. I mean, it's a great deal of difference. I mean, you have this stiff, formal facade with the US, but with the Russian delegations, you actually have some human feeling. So this is about human relations. And they understand that the US wants to exploit and keep them down. I mean, this is what they've been doing for decades.
Well, our guest there says that African nations are aware that the U.S. seeks to exploit them and suppress their progress. I would like to thank Greg Simons for his analysis. Now we now take a short break before our next topic on the need for Africa to rethink export diversification. Stay with us.
Africans urged to think export diversification. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development says African countries must diversify their exports to survive economic shocks from global crises such as the COVID-19 pandemic and the war in Ukraine.
In its Economic Development in Africa Report 2022 published last July, UNCTAD said African countries can diversify their economies through boosting exports of high-level services, expanding private businesses' access to financial services, tapping into new financial technologies, and implementing effective policies.
An African economist at this UN agency says there is a missing link in policies pursued by African countries leading to lack of export diversification.
Most of the diversification strategies have focused mostly on either diversifying away from one sector into another one, or maybe diversifying within the same sector, trying to add new products and services without ensuring that the conducive skills, technology, financing, and other structural factors are in place to kind of foster diversification into more value-added products and services.
Now, to discuss the UN report on the need for Africa to implement export diversification policies, we contacted Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist. Thanks a lot for your time, sir, today.
And thank you so much for having me.
The United Nations Conference on Trade and Development says Africa is among the least diversified regions in the world with regard to exports. Now, commodities account for more than 60% of total merchandise exports in 45 of the 55 countries in Africa, leaving them highly vulnerable to global commodity price shocks. Now, what's your view on the statement by this UN agency?
Africa's economy is dependent on primary commodity trade, and that already that faces, of course, fluctuations and is easy to suffer shocks in terms of trade shocks when such disasters and pandemics do happen. So diversifying into value-added products, but also into higher value chains of products and trade, then makes it more easier for Africa not only to sustain her economy, but also to become competitive at the global value chains at this cost. So it is a very valid and fundamental fundamental prescription at a time when African countries are looking at jump-starting their economies post-COVID-19, but also when they have just concluded the continental free trade area that seeks to increase intra-African trade, but also Africa's trade with third parties.
British trade unions opposed to the European Union say a £30 billion a year subsidy regime allows the EU to dump thousands of tons of heavily subsidized food into Africa every year. As a result, local producers cannot export their products because they compete with the lower prices made possible by the EU's common agricultural policy. African and European farmers have been holding protests outside EU offices calling for an end to dumping by the EU. At this demonstration, an African activist explains how unfair EU subsidies are hurting African dairy farmers and forcing young people to migrate to Europe.
It's important because we have more than 40 million of people in West Africa who are living from milk production and livestock. So when you destroy their livelihood, they have no choice to migrate in Europe or abroad.
Half colonial and imperialist powers contributed to the stifling of industrial growth and value addition chain in Africa so that their own industries continue to thrive at the expense of Africa's industrial development?
The factories, the industry sector of Europe, be it from energy, be it from markets, be it from value addition, it is heavily reliant on Africa for the raw materials. So take raw materials out of the equation and the industrial sector in Europe, the manufacturing sector in EU would collapse. And that is why the EU, through agreements like the Economic Partnership Agreement, has been fighting so hard to ensure that we have, that the EU gets unhindered access to raw materials, but also unfair liberal trade regimes where cheap products from the EU will find their way in Africa and threatening.
The African Continental Free Trade Area aims to create a single market for the continent's 1.4 billion people. Speaking last year during the opening of Secretarial for the Continental Trade Body in Accra, Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo reiterated his country's preparedness to lead in the implementation of the African Continental Free Trade Area Initiative.
In Ghana, believe that an increase in trade is the surest way to deepen regional integration in Africa. It will mean a rapid increase in the exchange of agricultural, industrial, financial, scientific, and technological products, which would significantly enhance our economic fortunes as a continent, create prosperity, and provide opportunities for employment for the broad masses of Africans, particularly the youth.
UNCTAD says high knowledge-intensive services such as information technology and financial services could be a game changer for Africa, but they account for only 20% of the continent's service exports, leaving immense room for growth. Now, how can this sector be boosted in Africa?
Yeah, of course, that is happening. Currently, Africa is experiencing what development commentators call premature deindustrialization. Now, premature deindustrialization is where you find that the services sector, ICT and all that, is growing more and at a higher level than the manufacturing sector. Usually it is the manufacturing sector which should grow and then provide a base for other sectors like the services sector to start growing. Unfortunately, we are seeing differently, and that's why we are having premature industrialization now. In order to ensure that we look at that the public, the ICT sector and the technology aspects contribute to development, it is important that we leverage on agriculture. We bring back connecting ICTs into the productive sector like agriculture, agro-industrialization, because our economies as Africa are built on the agricultural sector.
The African Union Summit on Industrialization and Economic Diversification will be held in November. Now touted as a highly anticipated timely gathering, the summit is expected to unlock the continent's potential to industrialize. Now, are you hopeful that this summit will bring the desired changes?
No, it won't. Because later we need to, I am sorry for sounding pessimistic, because all the flags, the red flags already point to that, my pessimism, because when you look at the requirements for Africa's industrialization and structural transformation, issues of technology transfer, issues of mineral beneficiation, to date, 97% of the mining agreements and contracts in Africa are owned by foreign entities, non-African. Value addition to date in majority of African countries, value addition in the extractive sector takes place out of Africa. And there has been a lot of challenges when it comes to industrialization, when it comes to agro-processing, when it comes to infrastructure that is responsive for industrialization, when it comes to technology transfer.
Now there you have it. Imperialist powers are not keen on seeing Africa attaining rapid industrialization. So it is incumbent on African countries to liberate themselves from dependency on parasitic Western countries. I would like to thank our guest, Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist, for his incisive analysis today. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you. Goodbye for now.
The ocean of dua.
Al-Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam ziyaratan minni wa niyabatan an walidayya.
Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves?
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of زيارة إمام الحسين عليه السلام, زيارة العاشوراء. So stay with us.
ولعن الله ابن مرجان ولعن الله عمر بن سعد ولعن الله شمرا.
Brothers and sisters, we have reached this excerpt of زيارة العاشوراء. وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ آلَ زِيَادٍ وَآلَ مَرْوَانٍ. And may Allah distance from His mercy the clan of Ziyad and the clan of Marwan. From this part of Ziyaratul Ashura, Desire, the one who recites this Ziyarah, he is taught to curse specific groups of people who played fundamental roles in oppressing those who were in the plains of Karbala. Now, about the true meaning of la'n, we said that it means to pray to Allah to distance from His mercy those who deserve to be distanced. But the meaning of curse is invocation of evil on someone, and by having a look at the true definition of these two words, we understand that the word curse cannot really replace the word la'an in our translation. So whenever we employ the word curse, we are referring to its accurate meaning of la'an when we are moving on in our discussions, translating the parts, for example, like this part, la'an Allahu ala Ziyad, may Allah curse ala Ziyad, the clan of Ziyad. The true meaning is, may Allah distance from His mercy the clan of Ziyad. So this is the true meaning. And whenever, from now on, we use the word curse, we refer to the accurate meaning of la'an. Now, let's talk about the word sab a bit. In the Arabic language, the word sab is quite different from the word la'an. Sab means shatm, and to speak ill of someone or somebody. And its etymological meaning is to cut. Some experts of lexicography believe that even the word sab is more stern than shatm, because shatm means to speak ill of someone, but sab is not like that. So it is incorrect to say that by invoking Allah to expel those who deserve to be expelled, by praying to Allah to distance those who deserve to be distanced from His mercy, we are speaking ill of someone. We are not actually employing abusive language about those people. This is what has been reflected in the Holy Quran too. Imam Ali alayhi salam is reported to have said, إِنِّي أَكْرَهُ لَكُمْ أَن تَكُونُوا سَبَّابِينَ وَلَكِنَّكُمْ لَوْ وَصَفْتُمْ أَعْمَالَهُمْ وَذَكَرْتُمْ حَالَهُمْ كان أصوب في القول وأبلغ في العذر. I indeed dislike you to be frequent vilifiers, but were you to describe their actions and mention their estate, it would be more correct in speech and more convincing in excuse.
When people ask, I'm confused about which school is right, or which madhab is right, go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, I'm confused, say, please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion. You will see it completely exemplifies. It clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is do not allow tyranny, do not allow evil doing, do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah, he appreciates Him, he understands His dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts no matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we are talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
So what we can say as conclusion is that the Holy Quran is giving us light in this concept. And since it is the fundamental source of Islam, those who carefully read it will have no doubt that Islam permits a believer to express la'an to a category of people who deserve to be distanced from his mercy. For example, إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يَكْتُمُونَ مَا أَنزَلْنَا مِنَ الْبَيِّنَاتِ وَالْهُدَى مِنْ بَعْدِ مَا بَيَّنَّاهُ لِلنَّاسِ فِي الْكِتَابِ أُولَٰئِكَ يَلْعَنُهُمُ اللَّهُ وَيَلْعَنُهُمُ اللَّاعِنُونَ. Those who conceal what we have sent down of manifest proofs and guidance, they shall be cursed by Allah and cursed by the cursors. Now, we truly know, according to the Holy Quran, that our Prophet ﷺ never spoke out of his own desire. The source of what he says is divine revelation. This is what the Holy Quran says. And there are traditions that clearly say that Allah the Exalted ordered his messenger to openly announce to people the succession of Imam Ali alayhi salam in specific place. And if he were not to do so, then he would have failed in communicating the divine message in its total form. So, the ones who conceal this divine revelation are cursed by Allah. And those are the ones who never repented. That is why they are always cursed by the Almighty Allah. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
أنت الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين الروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.